You're listening to a stage talk titled Monitoring Damage to Cultural Heritage in Volatile Regions. This week, we looked into how open source methodology and research is helping efforts to document, analyze, and report cases of cultural erasure when it's not possible to get boots on the ground during an ongoing conflict. How do you identify at-risk or destroyed heritage sites? And how does this process of documentation help to deter future destruction? You can find all the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by Bellingcat senior researcher Jake Godin, with support from me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday, the 5th of December, 2024, in the Bellingcat Discord server.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Bellingcat Stage Talk series. This week, we're joined by the team behind Caucus Heritage Watch, Dr. Adam Thomas Smith, Distinguished Professor of Arts and Sciences at the Department of Anthropology at Cornell University, as well as Dr. Lori Hachadorian, Associate Professor, Department of Near East Studies at Cornell. CHW focuses on monitoring at-risk heritage caught in the crossfire of the ongoing Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and was founded in 2020 to monitor and document endangered and damaged cultural heritage using high-resolution satellite imagery. Today, we're hoping to cover why and how you can use open-source tools to monitor this type of impact during times of conflict. That's speaking from experience of the Cornell unit looking into Nagorno-Karabakh and Bellingcat's experience covering destruction of cultural spaces in Gaza, Ukraine, and Bangladesh. As we talk, please put your questions in the chat, and I'll make sure to ask them as we move into the Q&A section. And now I'll pass over to Adam and Lori to kind of talk through their work.
Great. Hi, thanks everyone for being here, and thanks to Jake and Bellingcat for having us. We're so happy to talk about our work and field your questions. So maybe we can get started by just telling you a little bit about Caucasus Heritage Watch, who we are, when we got started, and why. As Jake mentioned, Adam and I are both archaeologists at Cornell, and we formed Caucasus Heritage Watch immediately after the Russian-brokered ceasefire to the second Nagorno-Karabakh war. The ceasefire was signed on, I think, November 9th, 2020, and we formed on November 10th, together with our colleague Ian Lindsay, who is a core member of our team and another co-founder at Purdue University. And he's also an archaeologist, and the three of us have been working in the Caucasus as archaeologists for decades. And so we came to this work already with a profound interest and experience in the cultural heritage landscapes of the region. And we formed our group immediately after the war, because there were really widespread concerns about the fate of cultural heritage. In fact, cultural heritage had been in the crosshairs of this conflict since the beginnings in the 1990s, in the aftermath of the first Nagorno-Karabakh war. Armenian cultural heritage had sustained large-scale destruction in a region of Azerbaijan called Nakhchivan. And likewise, there were reports that Azerbaijani and Islamic cultural heritage had also sustained a great deal of damage in the Karabakh region. So many practitioners and experts and observers were immediately worried that in the aftermath of the war, with the transfer of territories to Azerbaijani jurisdiction, all of the cultural heritage monuments, particularly the Armenian medieval and early modern monuments on those territories, would be at risk of damage or destruction. There was this sense of impending peril that really became heightened in the aftermath of the war. At the same time, there was a real dearth of information. It was very difficult to get reliable information about what was going on in the region to cultural heritage sites. A lot of accusations swirling around, a lot of propagandistic sort of state narratives that couldn't be verified because the evidence was insufficient to independently verify. So we were in a kind of context where there was sort of a information void and yet a lot of vitriol and a lot of fear about what was going to happen to these monuments. And so this was the context in which we formed our group. The reason why we felt this sort of systematic program of satellite-based documentation and monitoring was needed to provide the kind of independent, reliable, evidence that could be available to the public, to journalists, to legal institutions, and to heritage organizations around the world. In starting this project, I should say that we were also very much informed by the precedents that existed before us, especially in the aftermath of the Iraq War, the American invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's really the earliest instance where archaeologists used the earliest commercial satellite imagery to document the looting of cultural heritage sites. An archaeologist named Elizabeth Stone really set the precedent. And then in the midst of the Syrian civil war, another group of archaeologists really mounted the first large-scale program of systematic satellite-based monitoring of cultural heritage sites using commercially available and government satellite imagery. So these folks who came before us, the archaeologists who attempted this successfully before us, really provided a kind of inspiration and a model for us, even as with any conflict, the circumstances and the technologies needed are sort of different in each and every case. Nevertheless, there were earlier precedents that informed our work. So that I can pass off to Adam maybe to talk a little bit about how we work and what we actually do in our various investigations.
So one of the things that we were eager to add to the repertoire of investigations of heritage at risk was to develop an understanding of how did heritage come to be at the center of a conflict. There's something unfamiliar, in a sense, about why would one start shooting at buildings and demolishing mosques or churches or mausolea or cemeteries amidst an armed conflict. So one of the questions that we posed as we started Caucasus Heritage Watch was, why is cultural heritage in the middle of this conflict? So that meant we had to do not only the kind of monitoring that groups had been doing, archaeologists have been doing for looting in places like Syria, but it meant we also had to do historic investigations alongside the monitoring work to come to an understanding of exactly how heritage came to be at the center of conflict. And so our historical investigations that we've done to date, we've done two. One focused, as Laurie mentioned already, on the Azerbaijani province of Nakhchivan, where our historical investigations documented the most complete program of cultural erasure ever documented. 108 out of 110 sites have been completely removed from the heritage scape. These include medieval churches, cemeteries, early modern sites, that have been completely eradicated, effectively erasing all of the Armenian presence from the province of Nakhchivan. There have been, of course, more extensive programs of heritage demolition in terms of raw numbers. But in terms of the percentage complete of erasure, there is none that rival the Azerbaijani eradication of heritage in Nakhchivan. So that was historical investigation number one. And the second one we accomplished was an investigation of Azerbaijani heritage in Nagorno-Karabakh, around which there was a great deal of misinformation circulating on social media about the extent of damage. And there we found a complex picture, which showed some evidence of clear attacks and damage of cultural heritage, but nothing like what we could attribute to a state-sponsored program of erasure, because a great deal of the inventory of sites remain, and indeed still remain today. The methodologies required for historical investigations are a little bit different than those for monitoring work. It requires detective work on site inventories. So particularly if you're trying to create an inventory of sites that have been erased, it's very difficult to find those because you can't just go to Google Earth and see the site in existence because it's not there anymore. And so one of the first challenges we faced was how do we create an inventory of sites that don't exist anymore? And so that required going to the ethnohistoric literature first. We had a very useful set of material investigations accomplished during the Soviet period in Nakhchivan by a researcher named Argam Ayvazyan, who was truly intrepid in the way he conducted sometimes surreptitious observations to inventory Armenian heritage that remained. And so we started with his documentation, which oftentimes was, you know, if you go down a road off the village to the left and you ask the guy there or here where the church is, you'll see that it's 100 paces down to the left. That's the kind of ethnohistoric geolocation that we had to work with. But probably the most important sources for the historic investigations in Nakhchivan were the declassified hexagon satellite imagery from the U.S. reconnaissance services from the 1970s and 80s
that gave us a pre-war baseline image of most of the sites that we were inventorying. And also the sort of declassified Soviet topographic maps that ended up filtering out of the Soviet Union after the collapse of the USSR, which were extremely detailed and extremely good at documenting the presence of sites. So in order to then do that kind of work in Nagorno-Karabakh, we actually also had access to social media imagery, because we now had soldiers filtering back into the area. And there we were able to also use more traditional forms of open source intelligence from Telegram and other kinds of sources that provided us with imagery for geolocation and for impact assessment data as well. Why don't I press back to you for the monitoring discussion, Laurie?
Sure. So those two historic investigations that each took a year, and they, your audience may be interested in learning more, they each have their own dedicated websites with massive numbers of story maps. All of the satellite evidence is publicly available, with sort of one of our ethos, much like Bellingcat, trying to make our work as visible as possible. So those investigations are there, and they really, especially the satellite investigation of the destruction in Nakhchivan, which we call silent erasure, it really kind of reinforced the need for monitoring. People often ask us, why are you spending so much time and resources monitoring hundreds of cultural heritage sites in Karabakh as we are now? And the answer to that resides in that first investigation, because the erasure was so total, so precise, so strategic, so extensive, and that it really provides the basis for the rationale for why we're monitoring in the way we are. So immediately after the ceasefire, we simultaneously, in parallel to those investigations, mounted this monitoring program. And the way we work is we, first of all, have an inventory of sites. That inventory is based on a combination of state lists that are publicly available that the unrecognized Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh compiled over the 30 years of Armenian control in the region. Those lists are invaluable but imperfect in terms of geolocation. They include hundreds of sites. In some cases, they include geographic coordinates, but the coordinates are often far off or somewhat off. And as anyone in this line of work knows, like precision, it's all about precision. If your coordinates are even 5 meters off, you could be monitoring the wrong site. So we spent months and actually continue to refine the geolocation of these hundreds of sites that we're monitoring. At present, it's about 500 sites. That number has increased as the conflict has shifted, especially after the 2023 evacuation of the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh and the fall of the unrecognized Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh. That final kind of blow transferred vast additional territories with hundreds of additional cultural heritage sites to Azerbaijani jurisdiction and caused our data set to more than double, or approximately more than double. So we have this inventory of some 500 sites. We work closely with a couple partner organizations in Armenia that have also helped us refine that inventory and helped us with geolocation. And here, by the way, I want to give a shout out to Dr. Husi Gulyan, who's a member of our team and our geolocation guru, who's done so much of the painstaking work of all of the geolocation, both in those historic investigations and in our monitoring work. So want to make sure to acknowledge his incredible efforts. So what we do is we actually task Planet Labs to provide satellite imagery for us. So our work is at certain points relies on open source intelligent resources. And then at other times we have to rely on paid satellite imagery, especially for the monitoring work. And that's largely because the Caucasus region just doesn't have the kind of coverage that other hotspots around the world have on open source platforms, for example, like Google Earth. So you really can't do this kind of systematic monitoring relying only on those open source platforms. Or if you can, it would be the frequency of image collection is so low and maybe only centered on certain urban areas that it's just not sufficient to systematically monitor a situation like this. So we do rely on task satellite imagery working with Planet, and we collect imagery a couple times a year. And then our team monitors manually. So it's a tedious and laborious process. We can talk about the prospects for AI and automated change detection, which is something we're thinking about. But for now, we do this manually, our team of four or five monitors. And every 6 months, we collectively go through all of the 500 sites. I should say what these sites are. I mean, they're historic cemeteries. Some of them have the distinctive Armenian burial markers or cross stones called Khachkars, which is a UNESCO listed intangible heritage object. Some of them don't. They just have tombstones with, you know, inscriptions. Many of them are quite old with historic tombstones. Others are cemeteries that continue to be in use or continued to be in use until the Armenians left the region. And then churches, modest churches in villages, more elaborate and architecturally striking ecclesiastical buildings in some parts of the region, monasteries, some of which are very well known for their distinct architectural contributions and artistic elements. So it really ranges, but we really do focus mostly on sites that are associated with the region's longstanding Armenian community. There are, of course, also many older archaeological sites in the region. These are not a primary focus of our monitoring work because we don't see them to be particularly at risk. It's really the targeting of cultural heritage has really centered on the Armenian monuments that are associated with that living community. And so when we detect findings, I can say a few words about sort of what we look for. We have three categories of impact. We document complete destruction or just destruction, and then damage where we see partial impact to sites. And then we have a category that we call threat. And in some ways, I think threat might be one of the most interesting of our impact categories, because that's where we're documenting evidence of earth moving in the vicinity of cultural heritage sites. Jake, we just talked about this a few moments ago before we started, where it seems like, you know, there's activity near a monument that really shouldn't be there. And so there we're trying to kind of capture a picture of an impending possible damage or destruction event before it occurs, and disseminate information about that in the hopes of deterring, in the hopes of preventing further impact. So I would say that's one of our novel contributions in this whole area, is not just documenting things after they've already taken place, although, of course, we're also doing that, but trying to anticipate where the next impact might be by virtue of this category of threat, looking at earth moving. In some cases, we see road construction coming right up to the threshold of a church or a cemetery. So if you look at our reports or you look at our dashboard, I should say that we maintain a GIS-powered dashboard on our website, which shows our up-to-the-minute findings. Whenever we detect an impact in our GIS, it immediately reflects on the dashboard so that the public can see those impacts as we document them. And there you'll see the number of destroyed, damaged, and impacted sites. I should have checked those numbers before. I think our destruction is around 14, damage around 12, and threats are around 31 to 40 sites. Now, those numbers might sound low to you compared to sort of the situation in Ukraine or Gaza or other places that where cultural heritage is at risk. Here, I would remind folks that, or note the fact that the threats to cultural heritage in the Nagorno-Karabakh region are long-term. This is not a situation where we're dealing with heritage in the midst of hostilities, in the midst of warfare. That there also were impacts to cultural heritage sites during the wartime, in all of the wars in the region. But the destruction that took place in that Nakhchivan province of Azerbaijan took place over the course of some 12 years. Not in the midst of hostilities, but in, let's say, conditions of non-war. I hesitate to say peace, but in conditions of non-war. And so one of the unique features of cultural heritage and its threats in this particular region is that the threat is long-term, until such time as the animosities and ethnic hatreds between these communities abate, if that's even possible to imagine at this point. And so we're dealing with the challenge when you do this kind of research, satellite-based monitoring and open source intelligence-based research, when you're not dealing with the heat of a moment, the heat of war, but the kind of slow, ongoing, constant threat of construction and targeted destruction and so forth, sustainability becomes an issue in a project like that. You know, how do you maintain this kind of work over what could be decades, you know, where the threat might persist for some decades? So that's how the monitoring work works. I should say we work very vehemently by consensus. The conflict is so fraught, and the public discourse on social media and other platforms is so toxic that we are very, very careful never to release a finding or an assessment if we are not 100% sure about our determination. And one way we try to do that, or we do that, is by working very much by consensus. So if a team member sees an impact, we bring it to the group, and everyone has to agree. And if even one person says, I'm not so sure, I think we should wait till we get new satellite imagery in 6 months, we don't say anything about it until we're sure. And that's to prevent hasty assessments. That's to prevent any potential bias in our own interpretation of the imagery. And it's a core aspect of how we work as a research group.
We thought also, I'm aware of the time. I want to make sure we have enough time to get to questions. But I thought we might also just briefly discuss what we see as the importance of the work, both within the context of the conflict itself, and also within the wider field of heritage and conflict studies. First of all, one of the most important things that we provide is documentation. We are a research group. We're not journalists. By training, we are very cognizant that our role is as archaeologists, as to provide research and to provide a testament for any future assessment. So documentation is the first and foremost goal that we undertake. Certainly, we also feel that truth is a necessary condition for reconciliation. So we our firmest hope is that it's on the basis of a truthful understanding of what happened, why, and by whom, that we can begin to grope towards reconciliation. We have a theoretical interest in whether monitoring that's made possible by modern satellite imagery can actually provide any deterrent effect whatsoever. Measuring a deterrent effect is extraordinarily difficult because you're trying to effectively assess what didn't happen. And that's a very hard one for researchers to wrap their head around as in terms of measuring it. As social scientists, we think about the question of measuring impacts, and that's one that's very difficult for us to get a hold of. But it's certainly one of our core goals. We also, as part of that deterrent effect, the theory is that there's a reputational cost to heritage destruction. And that also is in some ways an unknown. There certainly is a clear evidence in the international community that there's a reputational benefit to involvement with heritage organizations like UNESCO, like the World Heritage List. But it's not clear as yet that international community has been able to impose a reputational cost as a result of the opposite of preservation, the destruction of heritage. That's something that will be both a matter of international organizations and also bilateral relationships in terms of imposing that cost. The third aspect that we're really concerned about is that even though we're archaeologists and we're fundamentally interested in the stewardship of materials from past human communities, we see the preservation of heritage as fundamentally a human rights issue, and this seems to be where the legal landscape is trending as well, as understanding that the destruction of a heritage site is never really about the destruction of a building. It's really about the unmaking of a people. And so understanding all of these sites in Nagorno-Karabakh and the threat that they face as a threat to a people, not just to an archaeological landscape, is, I think, vitally important. And it's certainly the direction where the legal landscape seems to be trending post the Bosnian tribunals, the Yugoslavian tribunals. And indeed, one of our contributions we see is to the legal landscape is through ongoing litigation in places like the International Court of Justice, where there is a fascinating case that could set a very important precedent for heritage preservation that centers on this conflict, Armenia v. Azerbaijan, that seeks to use an unusual international treaty obligation under the CERD, or the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. This is not typically thought of as a heritage protection instrument.
And so its application in this case is quite a novel legal theory. But if successful, it would provide a very important new basis for states to hold other states accountable for heritage rights violations. And our evidence from our monitoring program and from our historical studies is being used as evidence in that case. In terms of the wider field of heritage and conflict studies, one of the most important aspects of what we have undertaken is an effort to control the investigation and its research design. For us, this is kind of considered a part of research design. And so to the extent that we would be dependent upon Google Earth or whatever happens to be released in the public domain, it'd be very difficult for us to actually create a thoughtful and well-organized research design, because the most fundamental part of data collection would be out of our hands. So that's one of the key reasons why we rely on tasking satellite imagery for us. It's also, I think, important to bring attention to the role that heritage plays after conflicts happen. There's a great deal of attention that tends to be focused on heritage in the midst of flying bombs and mortars. And then it tends to lose focus. And yet so much of the cultural heritage destruction that happens globally is actually happening in the context of non-war. And here, probably the most fundamental and the giant case that very few people talk about, except a great research group out of Australia, is the case of Xinjiang in Western China, where Uyghur cultural heritage is being absolutely demolished at a scale that's largely unprecedented. And that is obviously not in case of conflict, but in a case of internal repression. And so it's very important, I think, that in those cases of internal repression, to keep an eye on what's happening to cultural heritage. And lastly, I think one of the things that's most uncomfortable for us as academics is that we decided at the very outset for Caucasus Heritage to be very public facing. And usually our work is quite, esoteric. That's a good word. It turns out that my earlier work on the Bronze Age would not get, 53 people in the audience at Bellingcat, but work on cultural heritage is of the public interest, and it's a public responsibility. So one of the reasons why we strive for extraordinary accuracy and clarity in what we do is because we are very aware that there are public stakeholders, a large number of public stakeholders for the sites and locations where we are seeking to make an intervention to preserve them. And so making our reports available to journalists and public media organizations, diplomats, governmental organizations, this is the key element, because making the observation of an impact is one thing. But if there's going to be a deterrent effect, it's going to have to be through amplification, where other outlets begin to notice and decry the advent of heritage destruction. So I think that's the wider context within which we see our work. And I think we'd be happy to take questions. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, that was very informative. I actually had a question at the top that it was something related to my own work with Gaza. And it was just defining like what is cultural heritage, because I found that I was getting a lot of mix with like, well, a cemetery. I mean, it's a religious site, of course, but also I guess it depends on the age, because some cemeteries are older than other newer cemeteries. But would a newer cemetery fall under cultural heritage just like an older one? So I was wondering maybe if you guys could talk a little bit about how you kind of like what kind of rubric you have, or do you just go by like the international definition under the, I think it's, one of the conventions that talks specifically about this is what cultural heritage is. So, I think that might be a good one to start out with.
Sure. It's a great question, and one we've obviously grappled with. I mean, we have decided for our work that we will count, regard as heritage what the people who live there regard as heritage. And so we use the lists produced by both states, by all states in the region. Azerbaijan has its own, of course, monument list that largely, substantially informed our investigation of the historic investigation into the destruction of Azerbaijani and Islamic heritage in Karabakh. And the Nagorno-Karabakh, the authorities of the unrecognized Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh, also over the years, very much in the Soviet tradition, compiled a list. This is something that has its roots in the 20th century, obviously. And so those inventories provided for us the primary basis for answering that question. If the state regards it as heritage, we do too. But what makes this complicated and what makes this question so good is that
as international conventions regarding heritage have shifted over the last 20 years, and especially with the passage, the ratification of the 2003 Convention on Intangible Cultural Heritage at UNESCO, the boundaries become more blurred. So that modern cemetery that you mentioned, for instance, where which has been a site of cultural practice, even if only for the last few decades, a hypothetical modern cemetery, the ritual practices that surround those modern cemeteries would be regarded as, at the very least, intangible cultural heritage practice. So we grapple with other complex situations surrounding these questions, like what to do with new churches that were built after the Armenians took control of those seven territories surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh, where Azerbaijanis were driven out of their homes in very large numbers. Do we count those new churches built on land where Azerbaijanis once lived as historic and heritage sites requiring monitoring? Likewise, what to do about new churches built in old Armenian villages where Armenians have lived there for centuries, but the church is new? So there are these complex cases, and I would say that we deal with each one, you know, individually and once again by consensus deliberation. But the main principle that shapes the data set is that if it's listed by the states, then we treat it as heritage.
I would just add one thing, which is that so therefore one of the ways to make heritage most at risk is to not call it heritage. And so there's a kind of lawfare that can be waged within government repositories to effectively preclude any item from entering onto a list to be called heritage, and therefore is not subject to that. So I think we're cognizant of the importance of using those lists, but we're also very aware of how easily they are manipulated.
Yeah, I mean, here I'll just add as an example of that, the Armenian cemeteries, even the old historic Armenian cemeteries, are not listed on Azerbaijan's monument list as cultural heritage, so they don't enjoy the legal protections of other monuments on the list.
Yeah, I imagine that, especially when you have, you know, a difference in control over an area, and then suddenly they have control over what's deemed heritage and what's not. I mean, I could think of cases like that, maybe in the West Bank or something, where you might have differences. We have a question from the audience. Westhammer asked, while documenting the damage and destruction is good for possible future use in case of lawsuits, wouldn't it be more useful to use skills and resources to help prevent the destruction in the first place? For example, providing a defending side with all intel available.
Well, one of the things to keep in mind about this conflict is that it's impossible to actually go there. So one of the first lines of defense for any heritage site is usually the stakeholder community of descendants who are invested in that site, who live around it. And for example, in Ukraine, one of the most formidable resources in documenting attacks on cultural sites are the Ukrainians who still live in the occupied areas that will take photographs and get them out to the West. We don't have that resource in Nagorno-Karabakh to provide that first order of defense and first order of documentation of cultural damage, of damage to cultural sites. So yes, certainly preventative measures would be the most useful. And indeed, the reason why we are so public with our findings is to try to achieve that deterrent effect. Our goal is to effectively not have to do this kind of monitoring. If we could actually be in a situation where the sites were not at risk and there was a good faith commitment on the part of the government of Azerbaijan to follow the injunction of the International Court of Justice, which has already told them that they need to care for and prevent destruction of cultural Armenian cultural sites, then we would be perfectly happy to go back to the Bronze Age and do our archaeological thing. But for the moment, that's not where the politics are, and it's not where the resources are. And it's going to be interesting, I think, as Azerbaijani citizens move back into the Nagorno-Karabakh area, what happens then to cultural sites? Because right now, it's largely the state that's an actor in the region. So whenever we see an impact, it's largely by an agent of the state, whether that's a contractor or a military unit. So assessing culpability is rather straightforward for us right now. As more and more people move back in, once that's allowed, culpability is going to be a much more complicated question.
Now, follow up also from Warhammer or Westhammer is what else can be done beyond just observing to stop or prevent further destruction?
To my mind, that is a question for the politicians. We often grapple with the "what is UNESCO doing" question, and the answer so far in the Caucasus conflict seems to be nothing. So far, Azerbaijan has gotten an extraordinary amount of praise from UNESCO. Within years after completing the, just a few years after completing the complete erasure of Armenian heritage in Nakhchivan, the First Lady was given the Mozart Medal, UNESCO's highest award. UNESCO was awarded the 2019 World Heritage. Baku was given the 2019 World Heritage Convention meeting. So right now, UNESCO has not had any ability to provide a reputational cost. And I think a lot of journalists might ask the question, why?
Yeah, I mean, COP29 was just a couple of weeks ago, and there was not a peep by anyone about this. And I think the United States in particular invests its resources in cultural heritage in conflict zones where it's places that they have a strategic interest. So, you know, the State Department mounted a very large program in Syria and Ukraine, too. They've, you know, funneled a lot of resources into monitoring and supporting Ukrainians, as they should. But the Caucasus conflict just doesn't hold that same status in the halls of Washington, for example, and in other major capitals as well. So it has been difficult to get state parties, to get governments to take any kind of action, either in bilateral relationships or in other, you know, diplomatic fora to put pressure on Azerbaijan. So, but yet, you know, we keep doing our thing and putting the information out there. But it's been difficult getting much traction in the halls of government and diplomacy to actually put some pressure on Azerbaijan for these actions.
I actually think that the success of the erasure of Armenian heritage in Nakhchivan, where it was complete, it was silent, and no one ever held Azerbaijan responsible, is one of the leading reasons why Putin has been very successful at attempting a complete eradication of Ukrainian identity in the occupied territories, and also why there has been a great deal of reluctance to say anything about what's happening in Xinjiang and China. And doesn't seem that global diplomatic service has yet figured out that these attacks on cultural heritage sites are not knocking over buildings or are just a problem for archaeologists, that these are human rights violations of the deepest kind that are actually warning signs for larger kinds of violence that will inevitably follow. And if they haven't gotten that message yet, but we're trying our best.
I remember with Ukraine, when I was working on that story with Maxim Edwards, who used to be at Bellingcat and now he's at Bloomberg, one of the aspects of cultural heritage destruction that we were looking into for the occupied areas was Russia's insistence that they switch out of the Ukrainian currency and start using the Russian currency, changing street names from Ukrainian to Russian. And so you have this like language change, you have this monetary change, just stuff that was made that part of Ukraine Ukrainian, and it's just getting switched out for another, you know, system.
There is a flood of materials, both from museums going out of Ukrainian museums into Russia, and also from archaeological sites. So it's material that's uninventoried in the sense because it's still in the ground, but that's flowing out of archaeological sites, particularly in Crimea, into Russia. And there is yet to be a cost to be paid for that.
There was another question from an anonymous user, but they say, perhaps a stupid question, but what common features or motives do you identify among all of the cases of destruction, and what are the common patterns you see when you're looking at Nagorno-Karabakh?
The most common feature is hatred. These are motivated by a kind of not just contemporary hatred, but by a historical hatred. It takes a great deal of animosity to not only want to defeat your neighbor, but also to write them out of the last 500 or 1,000 years of history.
Bulldoze the bones of their ancestors.
To bulldoze the bones of ancestors. That takes a level of animosity that is often difficult to wrap your head around. It means that what we're dealing with in these struggles is not just a strategic question of political territory, like who gets to boss around the people in this territory. It's an aesthetic hatred that's felt in the bones, to speak, of real animosity and a deep desire to erase people from the record.
I guess another pattern across many of these contexts is the 1954 Hague Convention, which is the first major UN convention that bore upon cultural heritage in conflict zones during conditions of armed conflict. The concern there was sort of the distinction between collateral damage in war and non-collateral damage, like the targeting. In none of these cases really are we, well, I can't say unilaterally, but we're seeing increasingly that the destruction of cultural heritage is not the result of collateral damage in the way that we saw in large scale in World War II, for example. More and more, we're seeing increasing evidence of targeting. And so that's a feature, I think, that is a shift from 20th century, say, discourse around cultural heritage and armed conflict.
In some ways, this represents a real collapse of a late 20th century consensus. So UNESCO essentially forged the late 20th century consensus that everybody was interested in cultural heritage and its preservation could be an outlet for understanding and peace building. That was the experience with large-scale issues, preservation issues like Abu Simbel and along the Nile. These were supposed to be the new order of heritage preservation as peace building. That consensus has completely collapsed. And it's very clear that there is now a new building authoritarian consensus that erasure is something one can get away with. And it's a way of dealing with pesky ethnic minorities that tend to get in the way.
It's almost like we should update the international law.
So the 54 convention actually was updated. There was a 1999 protocol and one other. That's the second protocol. There was another one before it.
In the 70s.
In the 70s, there was a protocol. And there have been some calls for the Hague Convention just celebrated its anniversary, 1954 right. to 2024, whatever that is. But there has been some, rumblings about how that we need a third protocol because it's been so incredibly ineffective. Like the 1954 Hague Convention has done nothing really to prevent or punish. So it's really proven to be a rather unsuccessful illegal mechanism. So it is, and UNESCO has shown to be, however large a bureaucratic behemoth it is. Again, I see the 2003 Intangible Cultural Heritage Convention as an indication that the organization can change and it can move, however slowly, to respond in that case to the calls of indigenous populations around the world to recognize other forms of heritage beyond the European monumental form. So there may be prospects for changes in international law around these issues.
Another question from the audience regarding the state-produced heritage site lists that were mentioned earlier. How do you deal with the potential cases where the state omits structures important to people that it doesn't like? I mean, how do you guys just kind of double check that with another source then?
Yes.
Yeah, we add those back in. So we provide a check on state unseeing. So if the state is sort of intent upon closing its eyes to certain kinds of sites. And also in our case, we have the state listing certain sites, but listing them not as Armenian, but in this case as Albanian, which is for your audience there sitting there, they can Google the Caucasian Albanians and find out about this rather poorly understood, but yet medieval polity that ruled part of what is today Azerbaijan.
The issue of lists, the lists are political documents, absolutely. And they have omissions and they have, we scrutinize them. There's another dimension to the politics and complexities of lists here in our investigation of the damage and destruction of Azerbaijani cultural heritage in Karabakh. The state list was actually quite incomplete because Azerbaijani authorities did not have access to those regions of Karabakh for many decades. So we actually added, and our inventory ended up being more comprehensive than the state's own list using those Soviet maps, using other resources, using open source intelligence, again, the efforts of our colleague Hussein Kulyan were instrumental there in actually compiling an inventory of Islamic and Azerbaijani sites that's larger than the state's own lists. So obviously we, scrutinize the lists even as we rely on them a great deal.
I had a question about cemeteries specifically, I think, because that's also something that I ran into myself when covering Gaza is there's 20 plus cemeteries that have been either been damaged or destroyed, some of them completely wiped out. And I'm curious about, I mean, when I had asked about that directly to the military and then Israel's military, they said, oh, well, there was, you know, it was being used by terrorists or like these things happen in war. And I'm curious if you guys have ran into like similar, I mean, you're kind of looking at cemeteries in more of like a post-con, like the bombs aren't flying, but these things are being destroyed. But I'm curious if that, if you ran into like similar types of, I guess, maybe excuses or reasonings behind the destruction of like a cemetery.
We'll go.
So one of the first impacts we detected was actually to a cemetery in the village of Metzkat Taver, was a historic Armenian cemetery. And there what we found was that the contracting company that was using bulldozers effectively used those bulldozers to, while widening a road, to divert them to the what I've called the collateral benefit of destroying the cemetery as well. And effectively pushing all of the detritus of bones and tombstones and material, it became the bed for the roadbed for the newly constructed road. And we've seen other targeting of cemeteries very clearly along infrastructure development projects. And I think it suggests that cemeteries are highly vulnerable because, A, they aren't listed, as Laurie mentioned, but also, B, because they provide some unique testimony to the durable, persistent occupation of a place.
Inhabitation
of a place. The people have lived there for generations. It's a generational token. It's a sign of generational life. And so they provide a particular problem for erasure. Sites and monuments can sometimes be appropriated into new state polemical historical narratives. Armenian churches can be reclassified as Albanian or whatever. With a cemetery, that's almost impossible to do because of the testimony of those tombstones. And so cemeteries in many ways provide the most egregious, or maybe that's not the right word, the most offending evidence of the existence of the other. And their persistence on the land. So I think that's one reason why they've been particularly targeted.
So in answer to your question, the excuse, although not a verbal discursive one, seems to be road construction. This example, like, you know, using infrastructure projects as a convenient, in a few cases, it seems as though road construction was a kind of convenient excuse to take out a cemetery beyond what was actually needed in order to build the road. That case is particularly striking in that regard. The entire cemetery was bulldozed, but the final road only clipped a corner of the cemetery's territory. So that's what we're seeing is infrastructure work and road construction is providing the conditions to allow for the destruction of cemeteries or damage to, I should say.
This is another question. It's similar one when similar to the like, how do you define cultural heritage? But from Irina MK in the comments here is, how do you go about the erasure of entire settlements and villages? Are villages and modern schools cultural heritage?
In general, we don't classify private dwelling places as cultural heritage. In general, mainly because, as Laurie mentioned, the descendant communities don't classify it as cultural heritage. It may be the inheritance of a family, but it is not the heritage of a total people. And therefore, what we're interested in is the targeting of sites for whom the goal is the erasure of a people. So that means that we look primarily at places where collective practices and collective memories crystallize into very charged built environments. And so in the case of Nagorno-Karabakh, that just happens to be in the Armenian landscape, cemeteries, churches, monasteries. In terms of the Azerbaijani landscape, it tends to be historical mausolea, also cemeteries as well, mosques distributed throughout the region. So those are the places of collective cultural practice that we pay attention to. We have been critiqued for not paying attention to the wider cost in terms of the built environment of the region, which was dreadful and hugely significant. We don't in any way underestimate the amount of looting that happened after the first war or the amount of looting that's and destruction that's happening to other sites after the second. Those are all parts of a kind of a cultural enmity that of which the heritage destruction is part and parcel. But at the same time, it's not the same to destroy, say, a Soviet era apartment building as it is to destroy a medieval monastery or a medieval church. Those have different valences within the human rights framework and different valences in terms of its impact upon people.
I'm curious, and this is maybe more of a technical question, but when you guys are using satellite imagery to determine destruction of sites or even looting, I mean, are there any telltale signs that you look for? I mean, I've looked at plenty of satellite imagery myself, and it's you can generally tell when a building's been destroyed. But I mean, on your guys' end, I mean, specifically with looting, I think that's somewhat obvious from satellite imagery because you see mounds start to appear from digging. But I'm curious, like, if there's anything that you guys kind of particularly look out for.
Well, you're right that when you're monitoring a building, it's actually pretty straightforward. First, it's there, then it's not there. Although I should say one of the challenges of doing satellite monitoring in this region is it's a very mountainous region and it's a very forested region. And so we often grapple with limited visibility because of the canopy, because of trees and so forth. And so seasonality is an important factor in our ability to see. Perhaps not large monasteries, those you can see under any conditions, but some of the smaller sites. For instance, we also monitor bridges, historic bridges that have Armenian inscriptions on them that are historically important. And those can be very difficult to see on the landscape, especially if they're in wooded areas. This is a real difference from Syria and Iraq, for instance, where investigators were not dealing with a heavily forested landscape. So the larger buildings, it's sort of presence, absence, and it's really not that complicated. Where things get tricky in terms of image interpretation is the cemeteries, because the cemeteries have small tombstones that are probably, you know, under a meter in length and width. And so even with high resolution, it can be very difficult to detect individual tombstones, especially if they're historic cemeteries where the tombstones are already somewhat embedded in the ground and maybe just peeking out a little bit. Judging by photographs, we know that's sometimes the case. And in those cases, at least with the resolution that's available to us, we can't see individual tombstones. So then what we rely on is, again, sort of government documentation, the passports for sites, the so-called sort of certificates for sites, many of which include shape files or include sort of the polygon or the area of the cemetery. We then geo-reference that layer, or we bring that into our GIS and georeference it so that we have the footprint of the cemetery and use that as the basis for determining whether there's encroachment within the area of the cemetery. So that's where things get a little more complicated. And that's where we're constantly, you know, needing not only when you geolocate a cemetery, you kind of try to see something. Usually you can see some sort of stipulation pattern or differing color patterns, and that coupled with the Soviet maps that have the cemetery mark, you know you're in the right place. You plop a point down somewhere in the middle. But once you start to see earth moving in the area, that point down in the middle of a cemetery is not good enough. Now you actually really do need the perimeter or the zone of the cemetery in order to be able to say whether the bulldozer has actually carved through it. And that's where we do this additional sort of process of seeking out the maps of the plan of the site and geo-referencing the belt or the zone of it, bringing that into our GIS so we can determine whether the impact has actually encroached on the cemetery. So there are visibility challenges, both because of the nature of the landscape, also cloud cover. I should say sometimes Planet is trying to capture an image for us for 6 weeks because this is a really cloudy area. 8 weeks, this last mission that we're kind of wrapping up now, I mean, the satellites are constantly capturing images, but the cloud cover is like 90%. So that's another challenge, technical challenge. But I would say clouds, forests, and small objects being monitored all combine to sometimes make the work difficult.
We have about 6 minutes left, but I had two additional questions. One, both from the audience. An anonymous question, though, it's kind of speculative, but how might the open sourcing of information, and you guys, you know, talked about this publishing everything, but I guess in general, the open sourcing of this kind of information have a deterrent effect or, you know, for future cultural heritage destruction?
That's what we need is to have a good sense of reputational cost, as I was mentioning before. It will only have a deterrent effect if it's amplified by diplomats, international organizations, courts of law,
publics,
and the public, like gathered here, to have it make it have a reputational cost. In general, even autocratic dictators don't like to look like heritage destroyers. It's not a good look, thanks in part to the 20th century international instruments. There's a general still sense that it doesn't look good to be blowing up monasteries. So you notice when Russia destroyed a couple of monasteries in the conflict, they denied any responsibility. They didn't say, oh, yeah, we did it, like non-state actors like ISIS have. States in general still see that being part of the community of nations, whatever that is at this point, actually should not involve destroying cultural sites. But I worry that that consensus is fraying. So the more we can talk about it, the more we can bring it forward, the better.
And then maybe just a bit of a lighter question to end on. But, you know, this entire user JV0 asks, this might be better prioritized for the end of the discussion, but how do you guys, this is a really heavy subject, monitoring cultural heritage destruction, and what kind of activities do you guys do to kind of decompress or release your stress, you know, like at the end of the day, after viewing, you know, 10 cemeteries that have been bulldozed, how do you, you know, kind of get that off your mind?
I mean, there are lots of ways to answer that, but I will say teaching is a very gratifying space to be when we're not doing this. I think we both enjoy teaching very much, and we have terrific students who've been taking our heritage forensics class and other classes. And even though it can still be on these topics, there's something just very uplifting about the optimism of young people still in our classrooms. So that provides some, you know, relief. And of course, as researchers, we have other research projects. My other one right now is about the Armenian genocide, so that doesn't really provide relief. But, you know, we do have other endeavors, other teaching and research things that we do that are not only about the darkness of cultural erasure. And then, of course, our personal hobbies. But
I mean, in some ways, we've already been professionally trained for this because archaeology is fundamentally about collapse and ruination. So there's a certain way in which training someone to be an archaeologist is training someone to maintain a kind of level of mental health amidst all of the evidence of human folly and the debris of collapse. So archaeologists, I think, are already highly attuned to the kind of heaviness of the enterprise. And so I think we seek out those kinds of stories that might have a silver lining. And even in this case, the hope that I think we all hold out that in service of truth, that there might one day be reconciliation, as I think fundamental to it. I remain optimistic that at some point, these two communities will be able to recognize each other's indelible belonging to this region. And at some point that will come, and hopefully in some very small way, having a documentation of what happened and what went wrong and what kinds of crimes were committed might be very useful to achieving that kind of new era.
Yeah, I feel the same way about whenever I'm looking at Gaza. It's, you know, I would hope that these sites can be rebuilt or, you know, preserved for the future, especially as more sites are found. Somebody asked real quick, does Cornell offer heritage forensic class remotely? They could attend.
Not currently. Soon. We'll try, and actually our students are just finishing up their investigative projects for the semester, and we would love to make as many of those public as we possibly.
We were happy to have Bellingcat make an appearance in our class last week, or was that last week, which was great. We've had forensic architecture visit our class that really combined sort of tools. Ayael Weitzman was with us last year, which was great, but it combines GIS, and they learn the sort of technical skills of remote sensing and mapping and geolocation, and then they also learn about heritage and the legal dimensions, cultural, theoretical, and so forth. So it's been a great course.
Yeah, I I could keep on talking about this subject for more than an hour. Yeah, if you guys are ever in DC, let me know. But I appreciate you guys taking the time to chat with us for this stage talk. And I appreciate the audience questions and Charlie for helping out. I think, yeah, we'll wrap there.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.